This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is February 28th, 2008. This is the third session with Professor Carl A. Grant, Department of Curriculum and Instruction in the School of Education. Carl, I'd like to start today and ask you about your observations on the undergraduate student population here. You've taught here for close to 40 years. How have the undergraduates changed or not changed? What special challenges have they presented? What changes have you seen that you've liked and not liked?
Well, over that 40 years, I would say that the majority of the students who come to Wisconsin, have taught over in the School of Education and Afro-American Studies, are extremely bright kids. Most kids that come to UW-Madison are kind of the cream of the crop from the state and other places. And I think this has become increasingly so over the last 15 years when there was a deliberate push by the university to attract the best and the brightest of the state and to have them to come to UW-Madison. And to give them a reason to come to UW-Madison and not to go to Harvard or Stanford or Michigan State or Ohio State or one of the other private universities or colleges. So the increase, I would say, in the brightness, smartness of the kids has, from my observation, has been there. But the kids who have come here over those years have always been bright kids, academically bright. Now, their knowledge of events, social in nature, social in as much as it relates to issues of race, gender, social class, those kinds of things. I would not say they was on a comparison of their academic knowledge. They were usually found somewhat wanting in that area because Wisconsin being predominantly a state that is basically all white, a good deal of ethnicity within the state, white ethnic groups, but as it relates to people of color, as it relates to people who are poor, as it relates to people who are gay and lesbian, especially as that group has come out of the closet, when they came out of the closet in recent years, you did not see that kind of sophistication there. So when I was teaching, especially during the 80s, it was always helpful to have in my classes a student from New York, a student from Chicago, a couple of students from Los Angeles or California. That always enriched the discussion in the class and would even facilitate the discussion in the class and would help me as an instructor to try to give the students in the class, mainly from Wisconsin, a reason for wanting to know, or why they should know. Because, as I used to say, that the students, teaching by and large a white female population who wanted to teach, and I would tell them, and this was no sexism involved, I said, you know, if you meet Mr. Wright, who's in engineering, and Mr. Wright takes a job in Philadelphia with an engineering firm, you're going to wind up teaching in the heart of Philly. And you need to get ready for that now. And the reason why I started saying this very directly to them, because it was happening. You would have a lot of young women who would say, well, I'm going back to my hometown and teaching and everything like that. Well, then 2 months later, 3 months later, they met Mr. Wright, and Mr. Wright was going off with one of these companies in a larger urban area, And which meant then that if you're going to teach, you're going to get the job in that urban area. If you know, from their point of view, if they were lucky, maybe in the suburbs. But often they were not that lucky. Mm-hmm. So the other thing I guess I've noticed, and I've been speaking about this somewhat lately, kind of informally, is that the victory that Barack Obama had in Iowa did not surprise me. I have been saying to colleagues and friends that I have noticed a shift in the attitude of the students, who are still basically all white, female, in my classes over the last 4 years, where they're heretofore in the early 90s to mid-90s, there was still a resistance to discussions of multicultural education. In many ways, I was able to teach it because students kind of got to know me. I had kind of a reputation in the department as a person who taught the class, who was, you know, fair to them. I would try to give them a reason for knowing why they needed to know particular things. But there was still this resistance. You know, why do we have to learn it? Why do we need to know as much? And the resistance came from being somewhat overt to being passive, so it was gradual. But within the last four years, I would say, at least half of the students, more than half of the students in the class had passed that. And they would want to say, Carl, how do we do this in our class? We see a need for it. How do we do it? I noticed that that change started about 4 years ago. 5 years at the most, and it has increased in the number of students who have a positive attitude who would say, how do we do it? Not that we should do it, but how do we do it? And so when that victory happened and people said, how did it happen? I said, with this younger generation we have today, they seem more willing than and students I've had previously. Not only to listen, but to be willing, as far as some of them are concerned, to step up and take action.
Is this true for the white girls from Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
As well as out-of-state kids?
No. These are the ones I'm talking about. These are the ones I'm particularly talking about. Huh. And I mean, you saw it in Iowa. I mean, so When that thing came out, I said, yeah, this is what I'm seeing. I mean, this is, they're willing to listen, and they're willing to say, what can we do? Because many of them are frustrated with things that are going on in the world. The other thing is the media has made it okay for interracial relationships, for gay and lesbians to be out. They have changed the rhetoric around people who are cognitively and physically challenged. So all of that rhetoric, since the time of many of them 18 and 19, in the last 18 and 19 years, has been changing. But particularly over the last 4 to 5 years, you definitely see things where people are making less of a difference about some of these issues.
Carl, you made reference to young white women. Has that demographic for teachers stayed about the same?
Yeah, still the same.
Not an increase in men coming into?
There are a few more men in the class. There have always been one or two in classes. Now, let's say three or four. Not a major change.
Are men generally opting towards secondary education?
I haven't looked at the secondary level to see if there are more men. It could be. I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what about students of color coming into education and teaching?
Now, I think since I started teaching, as somewhat there's been a decrease. Because as opportunities open up for people to make, to be able to make choices, professional choices, career choices, students of color have chosen not to go into teaching because often this is where they would track to. They could teach, they could preach, they could go work in the post office. So with the new, with opportunities opening up, they wanted to look around and see other kinds of, see what else was available.
Now, comment, if you would, on the quality of the kids going into teaching. And I'm referencing the teachers that you had as a child. You know, you talked about them as really outstanding figures who were really both astute and talented. Are the young teachers today, are there teachers like that coming along?
I mean, I would say so. Now, remember, I referenced those teachers. I didn't speak as much about their knowledge base, which was interesting. I spoke more about their relationships with us as students, the high expectations, how they pushed us. So from that perspective, you really don't see, I really would not know until I saw them in the classroom later on.
I see.
I would say, however, they have a fairly strong knowledge base. The students today, how they are going to perform with their students in the schools is still a question mark. Well, even although I've just said they have a stronger inclination to want to do, the schools still today are not embracing that. I mean, they will accept it, but they are not, the welcome mat is not out saying, come on, let's do these things. I mean, it's just, I mean, so these are the subtle things that you, that one has to look at and to try to understand. I guess the last point I would make, I would think their hearts in the right, their hearts in the right place. If given the opportunity, I would hope that they would step forward. But the jury's out, and the reason why I say that, because I have seen people who are ready to go, want to take action, but then when they get out in the real world, and if their peers say, "Why are you doing this?" Of the school climate is not supportive of their acting on these beliefs. They go with the Gores.
Interesting. Would you say that the kids coming through, the undergraduates coming through the School of Education, have as good a work ethic as kids of 40 and 50 years ago?
Oh, yeah, I think the kids today are very competitive. They're very hungry. I mean, these were the kinds of kids that, when I said, when I went to the University of Illinois at Chicago, they were that I ran into, they were highly competitive. They have been successful. As I often, when talking with my kids, they are used to getting their A's. They will knock you over in order to get their A. They will do whatever it takes. So yeah, a great deal of competition. That has not changed.
Has great inflation been an issue for you?
I can't say yes to that. I would have to look at that statistically, to say, and then somebody, then I would probably still argue, could develop an argument either way that the data would report. I don't think so. I mean, I don't think so. I've never been that pushed to give a higher grade. But philosophically, I am not a mean-spirited person when it comes to grades. You know, with me, it's how do I help them? If they say they want to teach because they love kids and they want to help kids, mm-hmm. that's my goal, is to try to help them to develop that. The grade notwithstanding. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't try to come in and say I got you, grade-wise. Mm-hmm. That's...
Now, when you teach your introduction to education, how do you teach? Do you assign papers? Do you rely on exams? Are there class presentations?
All of the above. Probably less so with paper and pencils exam. I mean, for example, I think last semester for a midterm, which I could have given a paper and pencil exam. And what makes me decide whether to give a paper and pencil exam or to come up with a quote-unquote a more creative way is really how the class is responding during the discussions to the readings that I've found. Because we always have readings. We always have a small group reports. If I can see in the class there is a passion or an energy, let me say an energy, around these discussions, whether it's small group, large group, and if everyone is participating, everyone, because each day of the class, I usually have class for about almost 110 minutes or something like that. Oh. I get around to every student. Every student will have an opportunity to speak in my class, or usually within the last half an hour, I'll say, who haven't I heard from today? So now, if that has gone smoothly, and I can tell people have read, the questions that they ask, what has gone on, then I come up with what I would call a more creative exam. If it seems that people, it's like pulling teeth, and I really don't know what people know. There's no barometer. Mm-hmm. All right? Then I would probably go to a paper and pencil exam to help me to glean that kind of information mm-hmm. as to what I need to do. So for my exam, this time I said to them, what I'd like you to do on Friday night, instead of going down to the local pub or beer place where you normally go with your boyfriend, you know, a girlfriend, I said, take them to Borders. They looked. I said, now, if they don't go with you, that tells you something. You need to cut them loose and find somebody else. So they all fell out laughing. So I try to really have a rapport with the students. I say, go to Borders and or any other Barnes & Noble's in your bookstore and go over to any section that you wish. I'm not talking about romance. Or it could possibly be travel. But start kind of an education. And select a book. It could be children's books that you would like to use with a group of students at the grade level that you would like to teach. Oh. And buy it. And what I want you to do is to come into class during exam time and talk to the class about the book.
Wow.
And the students in reporting, I mean, it was a fun time. One young lady said, you know, I told my friend when he hesitated, like saying, "I would meet you later," she said, "Carl said that if you don't go with me, I really need to have second thoughts about you." You know, so I mean, we had a lot of fun, and a good number of them discuss what happened when they went to Borders, a Barnes and Nobles with their friend, that just added icing to the whole activity. And they selected books. They bought different books. They said, you know, this is the first time I could select something to read in the last 3 or 4 years that I wanted to read, mm-hmm. that related to my college work, but I made the choice. Mm-hmm. Now, I would argue that I got more out of that. They got more out of that. I got more of an understanding about them mm-hmm. through that from it than any paper and pencil test.
Had you done that before?
I've done crazy things like that. Like I've invited the students over here and fixed breakfast for them while they may have read a book or they went to look up something special and give them a chance to relax and to see the other side, to see the other side of me, which is also important. About pushing and motivating them mm-hmm. to become the very best that they want to become, mm-hmm. all right? And, you know, so there's a lot of ways to assess people.
Are you still teaching?
Oh, yeah. I just taught the class. The example I gave you was from last semester.
And are you going to continue teaching for a while yet?
That's what I hope to. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And basically the introduction to education.
Well, I teach that, and I teach a graduate class. I teach a summer graduate class, and I'm teaching two courses this summer, one on globalization, because we're introducing a new area within the department dealing with globalization, and I'm teaching one of the first courses in that. I mean, I've talked about the intro class perhaps much more than my graduate classes, because I enjoy teaching the students, but I also enjoy my graduate classes too.
Carl, I wanted to ask you, I think I read in the paper that there's a new education center leaving Northwestern and coming here. Is that going to the School of Education?
I don't know. I haven't read it. There are always things going on around here.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's true. Now, let me, you touched on graduate students. Let's turn to that for a minute. Would you say that you probably get your greatest intellectual stimulation working with graduate students?
Then where?
Than anywhere else, than with undergraduates or your colleagues? Do you find
well,
the exchange with the graduate students challenging?
It would be near the top. It would be near the top of intellectual stimulation. It would be near the top. The other place I would say is from colleagues, previous graduate students,
uh-huh.
who've worked with me and have gone on, and we're still working together. I would say that would be the major source of my stimulation. The second would be the current graduate students, yeah.
And how many graduate students do you handle at a time?
I probably have about 12 PhD students, close to 12 PhD students right now.
That's quite a few. That's a lot.
Yeah.
How do you manage that?
Because I'm 24/7. It's not unusual for on the weekend for two or three, I mean, at least one or two of them to come over to talk about whatever they're working on, to come by and want to talk about something, and or to call me to talk about a paper that they're working on, where can they get it published, and so it's kind of a 24/7 thing. They know that I'm fairly open around the clock. I get calls at 10, 11 o'clock. The thing that they don't usually violate, they usually don't call me in the morning until after 10. I try to say, well, I'm probably working at night, so don't. You know, unless it's an emergency. Do not call me before 10. But it's really 24/7. And my son often talks to me about that, who finished his master's here in rehabilitation psychology. And he says to me, he said, Dad, what you do for your students, I just don't see other people doing it. In my department, it doesn't happen to me. And this is why I'm not really, you know, I'm struggling with him to try to get him to go back and work on his PhD in rehabilitation psychology. But it's hard for him to generate an interest because he does not see that kind of welcome mat that I provide for my students in his department. And I say, well, don't hold that against the people that you are working with. Now, one of the reasons you did not ask that I think if somebody pinned me to the wall, why do I do that with my students? It comes from two sources. One, in trying to find out what a professor is. Yeah. But two, and more fundamentally, from my father. My father spoke when he was in medical school, when he was in college. And as I think I told you, I cannot think of the name of the professor. And I didn't ask my brother this last night, who was my father's major advisor, who was so kind and dear to him,
yes.
Who would invite him over for breakfast or what have you. My father only mentioned that a few times in stories that he told. I don't think I really asked my father one or two questions about it, but it stuck.
Clearly.
It stuck. I didn't know it was sticking, but when people say, why do you do it? I know why I did it. My dad told me to do it. I mean, he appreciated it. And I saw the appreciation from him of what it meant to him, and what it meant to him is on his way to become a dentist. You know? So if it was good for my father, and he benefited, hey. You can't get any better than that.
And I have to assume then that that amount of interaction replenishes you and doesn't drain you.
Yeah, right. I mean, you're 98% right. I mean, you know, you
are human.
Yeah. I want to be honest. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's not that easy always trying to read a paper and give a person a feedback, trying to be sensitive in how you tell them but very deliberate in what you're telling them, figuring out how to push them. And as I said, I try to talk to them not only about them but about the total package, their family, whatever, getting them ready. Because one of my questions is, when they come to me, is where do you want to be 10 years from now? And if they say, well, they want my job, or they want to be here, or there, or everywhere, I says, that journey just began. It just began. And it's more than coursework. It's getting you ready for the job interview. I'm not that concerned about the dissertation, because I'm next to you as you proceed for the dissertation. But how do I get you ready for that job interview? When you go to that, so when you get to that you're selected to go to compete with those other three or four people who are terrific for you to come out number one. That's what the that's part of my job. Not just to get you, oh, I can get you through the dissertation. Ah, that's the easy thing. Because we're constantly interacting, but I won't be there with you for that. So how do we begin to get you ready for that?
Oh, that's a gift.
Yeah, how do we begin to get
you
ready?
That's a real gift to your students.
Yeah, how do we, and that's what a battle is. When you walk in that room and you have jackasses who come in who want to demonstrate that they're smarter than you, not to for you to them, but for their colleagues sitting there, how do you take that question, feel that question, treat that individual with gentleness as you talk in such a way that you communicate to that individual, I will be a good colleague of yours. And it is beneficial and helpful for me to be here. I'm not going to threaten you. I am worthy academically. I'm going to be a good citizen. All of that has to be taken into consideration. So to me, that's what I look at when I work with people.
You have probably had hundreds of graduate students.
I don't know how many I've had. I've had a good number. But then this whole area of multiculturalism really began to develop, let's say late 80s. It had always been there. I had always had a few graduate students. But let me say, since the mid, late 80s, 90s, et cetera, mm-hmm. increasingly, and now, you know, and it's a good number of students who just want to come and who will say, you know, I want to come there to work with Carl Brandt. You know, I want to come there and work with Carl and Gloria. And so it's you know, and that's refreshing to see.
Now, curriculum and instruction has the number one ranking,
yeah,
Chuck Green told me.
Yeah.
And as the best in the country.
Yeah.
So you all must be inundated with applications of students wanting to come.
Well, I'm on the graduate program committee, in which I look at initially part of the screening process. And I jokingly scream at Marilyn, who's the graduate program. I say, Marilyn, every time I come in, there's three or four damn more applications in my box for me to review. Yeah, and I mean, that's almost every day. I mean, so let me say, easily, I would say, six or seven a week, that we're getting and we're making decisions on, and so yeah.
That has to give you a certain sense of satisfaction as to what you've built here, I would assume.
You know, I haven't looked at it too much that way. I would say so. Especially to look and to see that people are saying, I am interested in getting a PhD in multicultural education. Mm-hmm. When in 1970, people said to me, why are you studying, why are you writing about this area? And people right here on this campus, in my department, tried to push me away from doing research and writing in this area.
Really?
Oh, good gracious, yes.
What did they think you should be doing?
Well, they thought I should be doing something like an ethnic studies, in which you would look at a particular group, like Norwegians study their history. Mm-hmm. African-Americans would study their history, and they would write about it. But that's never the way I saw it. I saw the diversity, with not a melting pot, but a diversity within people. And I saw our need as a society to understand this diversity, especially as it would come together. And we would all be in the same space. But it was more than just about race. Mm-hmm. It was also about class. Mm-hmm. It was also about gender. Mm-hmm. And I saw these things very early up, and I was struggling to write about them. It was not accepted, which, I mean, I'm not the first one who has an idea that people want to shut down, so I'm in good company there. But, yeah, people told me I was crazy, I would not make it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. It's interesting. But you, this perhaps isn't fair, persevered. It seems like you have a sense often of knowing what is the correct thing to do for yourself.
Right. Well, yeah, part of it, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm willing to stand up and do what needs to be done.
I've interviewed Gloria Ladson Billings, yeah. And she said that you were the essential reason that she came here. Can you talk about that a little bit? The two of you are quite a well-known team.
Yeah, I was funny. Gloria tells the story differently than I'll tell the story. And we laugh about it because we'll tell the story together. I mean, we'll be together and she'll tell it. And she'll say, oh, Carl, you're lying. Here's the way it is. So here's my version. I was at a meeting. I think it was in Washington. And Gloria spoke. And at that time, Gloria was at a school in California. Yeah. Claremont. And I heard Gloria. And I said, here is a person with promise. Mm-hmm. Now, I heard her. She didn't blow me away, but here was a person with promise. Mm-hmm. So afterwards, I went up to her and I said to her, very directly, very bluntly, I said, what do you want to be 5 years from now? And she looked at me. Now, part of the story, Gloria said she had come over and tried to have breakfast with me, but I was talking with someone else and she said, I blew off. I remember Gloria sitting there. But often when I'm at conferences, people will come over to where I am. Uh-huh. Sometimes I'm talking with somebody else. Sometimes they'll come to listen. Just like you and I, so they'll come to listen. Mm-hmm. They'll come to say, hey, Carl, whatever. So I don't say to people, get up. But usually, if they want to interact and join the conversation, they're welcome to join. So I said to Gloria, where do you want to be? And Gloria looked at me. And I said to her, do you want to come to the University of Wisconsin-Madison? And she looked and she said, in so many words, yes. I said to her, we'll make this happen.
Were you offering her a job at that point?
I was telling her I would get her to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I didn't have any power to offer anybody a job, but I believed I knew how to get it done.
You were talking about that yesterday on another subject.
Yeah, I thought I knew how to get it done. And I came back. I got it introduced. Then I got out of the way of it. Because had people known that or would have saw me out front with it, they could have easily have squelched it. So I came back, introduced it to a few people, got her to come here and give a talk, then I got out of the way. Mm-hmm. I went off stage.
And the rationale for that being that she had to do it on her own?
No. The rationale was, if people would have figured it was Carl Grant trying to get another African-American here.
Oh, I see.
They would have easily, that would have given them reason to want to say no to it. I wanted them to think it was their idea. The goal of the thing is to get the job done.
Right, yes.
Not to be there. I don't care whether I'm associated with it or not. But it's at the end of the day, what happens with it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I've forgotten when that was.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Was that in the 80s that you came?
Probably so.
Yeah. So, probably, is it fair to say that the reputation of curriculum and instruction rests on yours and her backs?
No! Oh, no. I mean, Michael Apple, Tom Popkiewicz, Ken Zeichner. I mean, I have some terrific colleagues, some outstanding colleagues. I mean, Michael travels all over the world. Michael's book, Ideology and Curriculum, was selected at the end of the century as one of the top 100 books to read.
Really?
Yeah. Tom Popkiewicz, as I said, I was just reading his resume. Mm-hmm. Tom has received honorary degrees from about 7 European universities. All right? Ken, about 5 or 6 years ago, was listed as the most quoted person in teach education. So I work with a good number, a critical mass of distinguished people. And I think it is out of that critical mass. I mean, we just lost a real good person, Jim G, who's now at Arizona, who was not here that long, but contributed to this push. I would say there's a critical mass. Now, there's a bunch of other folk. Jim Stewart, Mimi Block, Mary Gomez, who are all excellent scholars, mm-hmm. nationally known. I would say there's a handful of us, though, who I would use the word, we're kicking it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I mean, I have those who would sing my praises. Mm-hmm. Michael would have those that would sing his praises. Mm-hmm. Same for Tom, same for Ken. But no, I would... I would say it is a unit of people, of scholars, who are the reason. Plus, there's a whole faculty. Then there's the folk who allow us to be good. I mean,
what does that mean?
Here's what I mean. One of the reasons why I think we have such a dynamic department. It's because there's an attitude within the department that you can do your best. And people will not nitpick you. People will not beat up on you. People are more ready to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And that's extremely important. The other essential point is we have people within the department like Michael Stribel. Michael is in technology. But if I go to Michael or Gary Price with a computer problem or something, and they are professors, they will come here, they will come up. It is all of that that adds to a climate that says we care about one another. So if you care about one another and you work together and you stay away from as much pettiness as possible, mm-hmm. you can be good. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not just a few people. When people talk about a team, it's our clerical staff. I go in and say, I need something. It's on my desk tomorrow. I don't have to go down there and beat up. It's there 2 weeks from now. Mm-hmm. All of that goes in to being number one.
Yeah.
I would argue. People get out of our way, allow us to do things, and we support one another.
Now, Carl, let me ask you this. Within the School of Education, curriculum and instruction is certainly extremely prominent. Is the department able to throw its weight around, or doesn't it work that way?
Doesn't work that way. So I throw your weight around where?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm just thinking you're this good. Suppose you want to add two more faculty.
No. See, I would argue, and this goes back to something I said about had I been dean, they would have fired me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I would argue that our uniqueness, recognition, has not been taken advantage of. We have not been able to utilize that where you use something to get other things.
Leverage.
We have not been able to leverage that for greater things around the university. Now, over in science, they leverage that stem cell work to other things. We don't leverage. I mean, education is number one, two, or three out of the mouth of most folks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right? We don't leverage it.
Why not?
We haven't had people with that kind of sophistication to know how to leverage it. And because we have not really had a person in the chancellor's office, like a education president, we've not had a chancellor, education chancellor.
Oh, that's interesting. So now that gets me to one of the areas that we want to talk about, which is leadership of the university.
We haven't had that. We haven't had people with the wisdom to take advantage of that.
Okay, that's very interesting. But you're right. Everybody does talk about
the
School of Education.
You're right. We don't have people with that kind of wisdom. Up there. I'm not saying they're not smart people.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but that's they're into the sciences, which they're into the agricultural thing. And education is seen as it's a service.
Oh, I see. Secondary then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here we have a department, not only our department, but Ed Policy, Ed Admin, Education Administration, tops. I mean, we are listed as when they are throwing out how good we are, but for someone from the chancellor's office to take this and make it work, I haven't seen it.
Is that true even for Shalala?
Shalala would probably have got the closest. But she didn't do it. And this is why I said I would have been, had I gotten the dean's job, I would have been fired. I knew. After 3 years, I could have probably got her to tolerate me for 3 years. And I would have been gone.
Do you have any specific observations for the record about, other than what you've just said, about chancellors that you've experienced, any that were particularly hard for the school or helped the school in any way?
The present chancellor, Wiley, I think has been decent, but he's also been here at a time, severe budget crunch. Now, I don't know what he does in relationship at the dean's level, because I'm just a faculty member. all of them I have known. I knew Ward, I know Wiley, but as far as them, and they're nice guys, but as far as them dealing with education, no. That's not on that top agenda.
And if you were on the new chancellor selection search committee, what would you be saying? Or maybe you are on it.
No, I'm not on it.
What would you be saying to your colleagues as to what kind of chancellor you would want?
Well, I've been on those search committees, at least one, maybe two of them. And they are so neatly tied down with someone who's directing it that even the discourse where it is open is channeled. I mean, it's, and the people that they're going to get to come in, oh, I mean, you know. So, to be blunt, I think I would have very little effect. The room is large with folks, as it should be, but the people there are not particularly interested in education. I mean, if you get three or four people from science, as it's going to be, because science has a major role. You know, I mean, if you take a president in the United States, if something comes up related to medicine, could be anything, they call in the top, they go to AMA. Mm-hmm. They don't come to education. They think they know best. Mm-hmm. And that just filters down. You know, I mean, the typical mother or father think they know better than the teachers because they went to school. So, I mean, it is not an unusual way of thinking about how we think about education. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just kind of fits the mold.
Now, if it were up to you, and this perhaps is an unfair question, if it were up to you simply to pick the new chancellor, let's just for a moment think that you're God and you could pick the chancellor. What, and given your career as a scholar and a practitioner, what kind of person would you pick to lead the University of Wisconsin?
Okay. I've just finished a draft of a book that argues that the pedagogical space within the university needs to be changed. And this is brought around because of the influence of globalization. The kind of person that you need to pick for a university that is undergoing major changes because of the influence of globalization. The universities of today are not like they were in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s. They are struck by something new. They don't get as much money from the state. Mm-hmm. They are competing where the university once upon a time was said as the service station for society. Everything, the research, but there are research parks. All right? So the whole nature, the fight over international students for American university has changed. We are now competing, since the common market, with Europe. China says it's going to have a world-class university, number one university, within the next 10 years. It's open competition out here. So the kind of person, and plus, the education of our kids is for to help them get a job. It is not for a flourishing life.
Right.
All right? Mm-hmm. So, with all that is going on, I would want one, a person who clearly understands the changes that are occurring and can speak to them, not only from a national perspective, but from an international and global perspective. To understand what education, the importance of education, and the kind of education that kids in this country will need to enjoy life and to compete in this 21st century. The way, if we as a university, with so many people from the outside, from other countries, coming over here for an education, how we need to service that education for them so that they see us as friends. Many who come over here just come over and get our education. They may meet some people and become friendly with them, then they go back. Mm-hmm. Or some of them want to stay. But there is very little debate and discussion in the classroom over issues related, like from their country, this country, over certain issues that could be interrogated while they are here. So we begin to develop those kinds of relationships that will pay off later.
Yes.
All right? So I would want a person who, cosmopolitan to an extent, multicultural to an extent, understands all of this, is a good university administrator, but has a vision. See, the administration of this of a place like this, the budget and all that, I could have people deal with that. Give me three or four of the best budget schemes to look at to make some decision. Who am I hurting? Who am I not hurting? But you need someone who would a vision as to what this place is going to look like and what we need to do. I see the vision in putting up buildings and doing things for science and this. All of that's important. Stem cell research, all of that. But there's so much else I don't hear discussed.
Now, where do you find people like that? Are there people like
that? I would imagine there are people like that. I'm not on the search committee. I have not been assigned to try to find people like that. But I would imagine there are people like that. I think you kind of have to look differently than the way you may need to look out of the box for some people. In order to find someone who would be able to fit in to do what I would like to see being done.
Carl, are you not necessarily enamored of the Wisconsin tradition from promoting within for the chancellor's position?
I think it depends on the person. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, That's hard. I mean, Shalala came from, Shalala was unique. The other people have been promoted from within. They've been all right. It's been a lot of maintenance, keep us going, keep us where we are. But that vision, mm-hmm. Oh, give me a break.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the relations between the university and the state? How important is
that? Oh, it's important.
Is that going to change?
I don't know.
Should the university become private like Michigan?
No. It should remain public. It should not give up on that.
Certainly everything one reads and sees is that it seems to be inexorable movement toward continual reduction in state support for
right.
UW.
Right.
Do you think that's reversible?
I think it would depend on the next person. I think you have a person, a governor with Doyle, that the next person coming in with vision could sit out and talk with. I think Doyle would probably be willing to have such a discussion. I mean, you finished. You want more?
No.
But I think these are things that need to be discussed. I think the legislature... I mean, we do, the university does so much for the state. The university can be held up as a jewel mm-hmm. within the state talks about mm-hmm. What it has, mm-hmm. you know. But then people will probably say, Carl, you don't know what you're talking about. You aren't up there in this stratified air where we're walking around. But then that's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think we need to be a state institution.
You may have already answered.
Let me report. Presently, state universities are doing more for the public than private universities mm-hmm. across the board. Mm-hmm. So why would we want to go private?
You would get no argument from me.
Yeah.
It just seems
yeah.
to be...
Whether it's Wisconsin, whether it's Penn State, you just name them.
Uh-huh.
The state universities have been... I mean, we are corporatizing everything. It's not really working. Uh-huh. And the people are not making this decision. Okay.
I was going to ask you, and I'd say perhaps you've already answered it. What do you see in the next 50 years for the UW-Madison? What do you think, based on your life and your experience, what do you think is going to happen to the UW-Madison?
It'll probably keep doing what it's doing.
No dramatic change?
I don't think so. Keep building buildings. Keep attracting. Keep competing. Win some battles. Win out of 1 to 10. Win 7 battles. Lose 3 battles. Keep going. Keep his science. Keep attracting and keep the science area, whatever it may be, up front, high level. Maintain its other departments, whether it's sociology or history or whatever, and keep being the shining light of the state.
Now, Carl, you've made several references to science. You are a scientist. Your intellectual tradition seems to be grounded in science. Are you not in favor of science leading the UW?
Oh, no. I see. I wouldn't say science needs to lead. I mean, okay, let's say if science leads, how far out in front is science
okay.
from the others? I think the fact that we are number one with STEM cells, oh, that's great. I think that the fact that once upon a time we were number one with agricultural and not the and what you did with milk and all of these things, mm-hmm. all right? I think it's fabulous. Very proud of that, to be a part of a university that did those things. But where are the sciences? I mean, where's the art? Where is the humanity part? Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. I mean, the science can be out front, but then right next to it, or at least a step behind it, let this the other part that you need for a flourishing life.
I love your phrase, flourishing life.
Not really my phrase, though, but I'll be very close to it. Yeah. I mean, the university's great. Madison's a great place to live. Wonderful hospital over there. I mean, this. So in my saying, yeah, science. I mean, we need science, but we also need, and what I see, because of the influence of globalization, uh-huh. to teach people how to get along with one another, because we do live in a global village. And we need to work on that just as hard as we work on the sciences. Mm-hmm. And in 1948, they signed a Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. And for a while, every now and then, you would hear the human rights discourse. Mm-hmm. It is now coming back, because you have to have something out there as the world community comes together.
Yes.
So we're returning to this declaration that's beginning to have much more prominence today. We're beginning to revisit and say, what does this mean? Once upon a time, it only meant things to the nation states. Mm-hmm. Now we have to look at, what does it mean for individuals? We're beginning to look at that more. We got to do this work. We got to do this work.
It's a function of leadership, don't you think?
Yeah, oh, yeah, very much so. Very much so.
Who is going to lead us? Well, that may be beyond the scope of this thing. Yeah. But I agree with you, but people don't just spontaneously step up and do that. You need to be led.
Yeah, you're right. I
think.
Yeah, you need to be led. And you need a climate in which this thing can take place. And you see, the other thing I would say is, this is why this election is so critical that's coming up. Mm-hmm. I've read a couple of pieces lately, within the last 2 or 3 months, where people say, we're at the end of history. And when I've read those people, I said, what in the hell is this, at the end of history? And two separate places. And I said to myself, when I thought about it, and I didn't think about it that long, my retort now has been, if Obama wins, history's just beginning. Mm-hmm. And I seriously believe that. And it would be the best thing that would happen for this country. Not just, Hillary said the other day, what the sea changed for to have a woman in there, and I'm not going to knock that, but the sea changed to have him in there, mm-hmm. because of the way he operates, the way he thinks, mm-hmm. what he would facilitate, what it would mean, mm-hmm. what it would mean would open up the door for a number of things to happen. You're going to get some backlash. But the hopefulness of it, the idea, what it can provide for people, is what this nation needs. The time is more akin to Lincoln than Kennedy. Not Kennedy. Kennedy was talking about putting something on the moon. Mm-hmm. Lincoln time, the country was in bad shape. And we don't know I think a number of us don't really appreciate the extent to which how we are looked upon outside of this country.
Yes.
It's a horror story.
Yes. And you would know that because you're all over the world.
I mean, it is a horror story. I mean, just watching this television in this country and watching television when you're outside of this country.
This concludes the oral history interview with the extraordinary and distinguished Professor Carl Grant. Thank you, Carl.
Oh, good. Thank you.